The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello. For years, it's been one of the best podcasts available, The Misha Mission, which walks through every Black film ever made. And now, the hosts of the show, Len Webb and Vincent Williams, are offering a new limited-run series of podcast episodes which focus on a seminal year in Black cinema, 1989, a year that featured six films that left an indelible mark on Black cinema and the world. Harlem Nights, Lean on Me, Glory, A Dry White Season, Do the Right Thing, and Driving Miss Daisy. The new show is called The Class of 1989, and we'll talk to the hosts, Len Webb and Vincent Williams, today on the history of literature. Okay, here we go. This is a fun one. Everything I get from literature, I get from films too. I basically count films as literature. They are so central to our understanding of one another, of who we are and how we get along with each other. I'm Jack Wilson, by the way. Welcome to the podcast. Films are so important to our culture. Probably they are the literary art form of the 20th century, just as novels were for the 19th. And poetry was for the 18th. You know who would agree with me? Tolstoy, of all people. Maybe the greatest novelist of all time. Certainly he's up there, but he lived into the 20th century, of course, and he went to see a film, and he was transfixed. This, he said, will be the art form of the 20th century. What impressed him was something that maybe only someone who had toiled at writing can appreciate, the efficiency. He admired the way you can set a scene immediately in a film with no effort at all. Your characters are on the train. Well, show the exterior of the train for a few seconds, then cut to the interior. Boom. Effortless. A second to establish it. And an interesting second, too. Seeing something new is interesting. For Tolstoy, the novelist, getting people on the train is laborious. It's a few sentences, maybe a paragraph. Where are they? What's it like there? Who's there? Then you have to get them off the train. You have to stop the action and the dialogue to orient the reader. He saw how efficient the medium of film was. But it's not just efficiency that we revere. It's the power of it all, the acting and the music and the sound, the visuals. It's the experience of being in a movie house. The lights go down, the world stops. It's just you and this story, all immersive. It's no wonder that Oscar Micha said, "I'm in." He was a novelist too, but then he became a filmmaker, directing and producing more than 44 of them early in the 20th century, when you could have a viable alternative to the world of Hollywood. His world was based out of Chicago, and he was anti-Hollywood or alt-Hollywood in another very significant way. He was Black, and he made films about the Black experience from a Black perspective. His example gave Black audiences something to attend and Black filmmakers a reason to hope. And he gave our guests today the name of their podcast, The Misha Mission. The year 1989 gave them the name for their new podcast, this limited-run series, and what a year it was. The six films they've chosen, taken as a whole, give us a snapshot of where Black cinema was at the time, and where the rest of the movie industry was, too. The movie industry, if not the nation. Because that's the other thing about films, where they differ from novels. Novels tend to be by individuals, with the gatekeepers, publishers, arriving at the end. No one finances a novel in advance. There's no need. Great novels can be written in obscurity and find their audience through their greatness, as long as you can find a publisher willing to see the novel for its greatness, and sometimes even if you can't. It's different with films. Films don't get made unless people with money think the film will play for audiences. Occasionally, they might be willing to lose money on a pet project. But for the most part, you get this double filter. You get a producer who says, yes, I want to make this movie. And yes, I think I can sell enough tickets. When it comes to casting a black actor in a lead role, let alone financing an entire picture with a black cast or directed by a black filmmaker and so on, Hollywood for decades said, maybe here and there, maybe a Sidney Poitier now and then, but for the most part, let's not go there. Let's not ask our theaters in the South to show this. Let's not ask the ticket buyers of the Midwest to turn up. It left a hole for filmmakers like Oscar Michaud to fill, and often it just left a hole, period. By 1989, things are starting to look different. Morgan Freeman, the miraculous actor Morgan Freeman, is in three of these movies, three of the six. The guy can do just about anything on screen. Summon any kind of emotion and convey it through his eyes and face and bearing. He's an actor's actor, a character actor at heart, but so transcendently good, he can play the lead. But watching him in these three pictures from this year is like watching a masterclass in acting. He easily inhabits three very different roles as the servant slash driver for a prickly Southern lady in Driving Miss Daisy, as a black Civil War soldier in Glory, and as a hard-nosed and controversial principal brought in to reform a high school in modern-day New Jersey. So there's point number one for 1989. A Morgan Freeman can carry a movie. Hollywood is willing to cast him in big parts. Freeman's a character actor, but we also see stars, true Hollywood stars. Denzel Washington is on his way, although it's still a bit early in his career. He has an unforgettable part in Glory, but the movie is still centered around the Matthew Broderick character. Eddie Murphy is a bona fide box office star by 1989. He had been an A-lister for almost a decade. Harlem Nights was his chance to take the wheel. He writes, directs, and stars in this vehicle, another breakthrough for Hollywood. But the real breakthrough is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. I don't think I need to say much about this film. It is an American classic, so good in so many ways. Before it even opened in late 1989, Roger Ebert had named it one of the top films of the decade. On his list, two spots ahead of Raiders of the Lost Ark, one spot behind E.T. His summary was this: Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing is the most controversial film of the year, and it only opens today. Thousands of people already have seen it at preview screenings, and everywhere I go, people are discussing it. Some of them are bothered by it. They think it will cause trouble. Others feel the message is confused. Some find it too militant. Others find it the work of a middle-class director who is trying to play street smart. All of those reactions, I think, simply are different ways of avoiding the central fact of this film, which is that it comes closer to reflecting the current state of race relations in America than any other movie of our time. End quote. I didn't think I'd like a film or respect a film as much as I like and respect Do the Right Thing, but then I watched A Dry White Season, which was a revelation. I had never seen it before, had never even heard of it that I could remember. It stars Donald Sutherland, speaking of character actors who can carry a movie. He's like the white Morgan Freeman. And speaking of the advantages of making a film from a black perspective, the director of this film is Usain Palzi, a black French filmmaker. And even though the film centers around the white character and his journey, her influence shows. Sutherland plays a white South African during the apartheid era. A murder affects a black man who works for him, and Sutherland tries to find answers. His experience navigating the justice system allows him to see his world clearly for the first time. It also tears him and his family and his society apart. Helped along by a late period Marlon Brando in a key role, the movie is relentlessly compelling, with a dramatic rise and fall and a convincing resolution without a Hollywood ending. So those are the six. Let's do some literary news, then have our main course of talking about those six movies with the experts, Len and Vincent. In literary news today, we have Judy Blume, beloved children's book novelist and one of the most frequently banned writers in America. She's banned. We're going through a horrible period of banning right now as parents and agitators around the country are trying to pull books off of shelves. Judy Blume knows what that's like. Her books have been banned for treating topics like menstruation and teenage sex with honesty and candor. These are things that are on kids' minds, and a kid's world can be a lonely place. Judy Blume was there to help. As it happens, I don't have a great recollection of being helped by one of the more famous Judy Blume books, like Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, or Forever. But I was helped along more than I realized by one of her books. It is a famous book, just not famous for helping kids. Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. That book, I must have read it 100 times. Even the title, I realize now, was either formative or it was perfect to connect with me. As an adult, I loved books with titles like Diary of a Madman and Notes from Underground and Invisible Man, stories about the underdogs in life, the wrecks, the wretched, the overlooked, the miserable. It's what draws me to Kafka and Baudelaire and Poe. And there it is in the Judy Blume title, A Fourth Grade Nothing. I didn't really put that together at the time. It was just a title of a book to me. And I didn't have a younger sibling whose antics dominated the world, as Fudge's does to Peter Hatcher, his older brother, the Fourth Grade Nothing. But I can remember, even though I didn't have a younger sibling, I can remember the feeling that if I did have a younger brother, I would be the Peter and the kid would be the Fudge. At school, it was like that. I was the one turning in my homework and getting a smiley face stamped at the top. And the crazy kids, the wild ones, were the ones who made the teachers smile in real life. Those smiles where the teachers can't help themselves. Dutiful kids get pats on the head. Wild kids get everything else. I felt that when I read Judy Blume's book, and I felt that she saw the dutiful kids and the wild kids alike. She saw that dynamic. She saw how funny and adorable a toddler like Fudge was, but she didn't stop there. She saw how that would play out in the emotions of the older brother, who after all was doing what his parents wanted him to do and who got overlooked. And she made all of that real and funny. So, Judy Blume's in the news now because of a new documentary on her life, which I suppose I'll watch if it's on one of the streaming services I subscribe to. But also, she's in the news because of the book banning. She's still being banned. This is from The Guardian. Quote, "The author Judy Blume says a rise in intolerance in America has led to a much worse epidemic of book banning than she experienced in the 1980s. The children's and young adult author, whose frank depictions of adolescence and puberty have long caused controversy, said it was time to fight back against censorship. Her 1975 novel, Forever, which deals with teenage sexuality, was one of 80 books banned in one Florida school district last month for dealing with issues such as sex, race, and gender. In an interview on the BBC's Sunday with Laura Kunzberg, Blume said of book banning, "I thought that was over, frankly. I came through the 80s when book banning was really at its height, and it was terrible. And then libraries and schools began to get policies in place, and we saw a falling off of the desire to censor books. Now it is back. It is back much worse. This is in America. It is back so much worse than it was in the 80s, because it's become political." Public outrage is not new to Blume. When her book, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, was released in 1970, its candid portrayal of puberty caused plenty of uproar and library bans. Even her own children's primary school refused to keep a copy. Now, a screen adaptation of the book is to be released in May, starring Abby Ryder Fortson, Rachel McAdams, and Kathy Bates. Blume said she cried when she finally got to see her work made into a film 53 years later. I think it was my son who said to me, just wait until all those people who grew up with your books are in power in Hollywood, and you're going to see what happens. And I'm so glad that I'm around to see it. Bloom's books have sold more than 90 million copies and have been translated into at least 32 different languages. Asked if she was concerned about intolerance in the U.S., Bloom said, absolutely. Intolerance about everything, gender, sexuality, racism, it's just reaching a point where again we have to fight back. We have to stand up and fight. Bloom said she was also worried about censorship in teaching. Florida introduced a bill last month that may limit discussion of menstruation before the sixth grade, and the state's governor, Ron DeSantis, is proposing to restrict conversation about gender identity and sexual orientation in schools. I mean, that's crazy. That is so crazy, Bloom said. And it is so frightening that I think the only answer is for us to speak out and really keep speaking out, or we are going to lose our way. I mean, there's a group of mothers now going around saying that they want to protect their children. Protect them from what? You know, protect them from talking about things? Protect them from knowing about things? Because even if they don't let them read books, their bodies are still going to change, and their feelings about their bodies are going to change. And you can't control that. They have to be able to read, to question. They have to be able to read, to question. That's what books are for, people, and films too, since we're talking about that today. But there's something in particular about books. Films are communal experiences. Books are private. Books are just you and the author and the words on the page. You can feel that connection. You can feel as if someone understands. And then something happened with Judy Bloom. I'm not sure exactly what. Some online kerfluffle. Something got taken out of context. I think she said something about online harassment, and J.K. Rowling got tangled up in it, and Judy Bloom ended up clarifying her position by issuing this statement. This is like a manifesto for literature. I'm going to share it with you. This was on Twitter. I got goosebumps when I read this. She quoted a passage from her recent interview with Variety. It says, Bloom went on to say, what are you protecting your children from? Protecting your children means educating them and arming them with knowledge and reading and supporting what they want to read. No child is going to become transgender or gay or lesbian because they read a book. It's not going to happen. They may say, oh, this is just like me. This is what I'm feeling and thinking about. Or, I'm interested in this because I have friends who may be gay, bi, lesbian. They want to know. Bloom concluded, I just read a book that was wonderfully enlightening to me. It's called Gender Queer, a memoir by Maya Kobabe. It's probably the number one banned book in America right now. And I thought, this young person is telling me how they came to be what they are today. And I learned a lot and became even more empathetic. That's what books are all about. End quote. That's what books are all about. Bravo, Judy Bloom, and thank you. Len Webb and Vincent Williams are next. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast.
Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Okay, joining me now are Len Webb and Vincent Williams. Len Webb is a freelance podcast producer and creator of the award-winning geek culture show Black Tribbles and co-producer of the music podcast The First Time I Heard with Toya Haynes. Vincent Williams has a PhD in English and wrote music, film, and television criticism for the Baltimore City Paper. He also hosted It's All Soul, a weekly showcase of 70s soul and 90s hip-hop for G-Town Radio. Since 2016, the two have hosted the podcast, The Meeshaw Mission. They're here today to talk about a new podcast, The Class of 1989, which walks through a year of contradiction, controversy, and ultimate triumph for Black cinema. Len Webb and Vincent Williams, welcome to the History of Literature.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay. So, Len, let's start with The Meeshaw Mission. What is that podcast about?
Well, the Meeshaw Mission is named after the granddaddy, actually, of Black cinema, Oscar Meeshaw, who in the early part of the 20th century pretty much wrote, directed, cast, filmed, edited, and distributed his own original Black movie productions across the country, even across the Southern states. He was a one-man Black Hollywood, and in honor of him and his legacy, Vincent and I in 2016 got together to start a podcast where we will watch and review every Black film that has ever been made.
Okay, so let me put the question, I guess, to Vincent. Every Black film ever made, how many do you think are on that list? I could imagine the definition of what a Black film is would kind of give us a sense of the scope of the project here.
Well, the definition, much like Black films, is ever expanding. That's actually part of our ongoing conversation. Mm. What is it that makes a Black film? The example that I always like to use is The Color Purple is a film based on a Black novel featuring almost an entirely Black cast, but it's directed by Steven Spielberg, who is a white man, as opposed to 25th Hour, which is a Spike Lee film starring almost an entirely non-Black cast. Rosario Dawson might be the only person of color in there. Is that a Black film? So that's actually been part of the fun,
right?
Trying to nail down exactly what is a Black film.
Right. And when you say that you review them, I'm guessing you kind of give them the standard thumbs up and thumbs down and that kind of review, but also place them in their historical context.
Exactly. Exactly. Their historical context. The wonderful thing about the podcast going on this long is we place them within the Meeshaw Mission context. So it's almost like this ongoing conversation.
Yeah.
About how they relate to one another as well.
Right. So how far along would you say? Would you say that you're halfway through, or do you feel like you're just scratching the surface?
Oh, we're easily just scratching the surface.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is that even in the early part of the 20th century, or you go like the 20s, 30s, and 40s, where you might think there's not a lot of Black films of that time because Black faces just weren't prominent in Hollywood productions. Because of Oscar Meeshaw, there was a rather robust underground circuit of Black cinema that was being produced that fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of which has fallen into public domain. So it's out there for us to easily access and thus give a review and bring to a wider audience. And then never mind, once you get into the 60s and 70s and going forward, where the art of making movies becomes more democratized and people are have access to the equipment and budgets, even though they may be low, to really be active in the film industry. That's when Black films kind of start booming year after year after year, as Black people are able to take agency on their appearance and how they are portrayed in this media. Each year, progressively, you can see more and more Black films, more and more Black stories being told in richer and bolder styles and genres, and we're able to just really go to town on every one of them.
Mm, yeah. Well, I can see where 1989 probably jumped out at you, because it does feel like we were coming out of this era of the sort of standardization, and we were all getting films that were based on not only what Hollywood wanted to give us, but what Hollywood thought would play across America. And things started to change. And 1989 seems like a good pivot point for that. But what made the year stand out for you? Were you doing the Michaud Mission when you started to think of 1989 as being a particularly significant year for Black cinema?
Well, I think the nucleus of it, we always talk about, speaking of a running conversation, we always talk about the connection between Driving Miss Daisy and Do the Right Thing. You know, we always talk about they come out the same year. Driving Miss Daisy goes on to win the Academy Award for Best Picture of the Year. And as we always say, people, you know, sort of a shorthand is people will say, oh, it beat Do the Right Thing. And we always correct them and say, actually, it didn't beat Do the Right Thing, because Do the Right Thing wasn't even nominated.
Yeah.
So you have this. And then as we're going through the Michaud Mission, as we're talking, we realize these other films come out the same year, whether it's Harlem Nights or Glory or Lean on Me. So you have these films that come out. And then my favorite part of developing this series is talking to some scholars, talking to some critics, talking to some artists and filmmakers. And we have these wonderful Black women who pointed out that a dry white season should also be a part of the conversation. Speaking of what does and does not make a film a Black film, this is a film, in our defense, we didn't think of, because it's a film with, you know, it's Donald Sutherland and Marlon Brando, and it's one of these kind of po-faced late 80s films about apartheid South Africa. But it's directed by Uzane Palsy, who's a Black woman. And this is, you know, the first Black woman who directs a big studio production. She, you know, got Marlon Brando out of retirement for this. He goes on to be nominated for an Academy Award. So obviously, this should also be a part of the conversation. Yeah. And as you said, 1989 is such an interesting year in race and class and social stuff. So it all just sort of came together like that, I would say.
And this is a limited edition podcast, or is it six episodes, one for each film, or do you pair them up, or how is it organized?
We really took these six films and used them as a focal point to take a look at the industry of Hollywood in general, and then just the culture of Black people or the Black experience in all. So while a lot of people think that it's just six films, six episodes, oh, they got to do a film each episode. No, we really look at the different themes that are running through all of the films. Like our first episode, which talks about Ladies First Last, looks at, you know, despite Uzane Palsy directing A Dry White Season and leading that effort, we talk about the lack of the Black women that are really fully represented in the rest of those films, and how that is definitely that is exactly what is on the screen in 1989. Black women, their experience, their thoughts, their portrayals are just a second thought. You know, they're an afterthought more often than not. And even in these Black movies, believe it or not, we were able to reach and speak with actress Carla Brothers, who was a Black woman whose role was cut out of Glory because they realized that this was a film that didn't even need to have a Black woman in there. Now, you can argue whether or not that was a smart cut just based on it being a war film, but that seemed like a nice symbol for what we were seeing happening in Hollywood. But then Usain Palsy directing A Dry White Season and directing Marlon Brando to an Academy Award nomination, how telling that is for us to spotlight that in a year where you have The Woman King coming out with Gina Prince-Bythewood directing a phenomenal performance out of Viola Davis and Lashana Lynch and the rest of the women in that film, and that still not getting any type of critical acclaim that it deserves. So the story that we represent in 1989, we definitely make a point to point out that it's a story still being told here in 2023.
Right. Okay. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll return with a look at each of the films that make up the class of 1989. Okay, we're back with Len Webb and Vincent Williams. Maybe I should ask one more question about where was Black cinema as of 1988? So as we're on the verge of this year, what was happening and what wasn't? We had the Sidney Poitier films. We had Blaxploitation. In the 80s, we saw stars like Eddie Murphy who were starting to sort of take over at the box office. You mentioned The Color Purple in 1985, another film, Cry Freedom. We had Denzel Washington in 1987. But it does still seem like, I mean, The Color Purple was Steven Spielberg movie. Cry Freedom was a Richard Attenborough movie. And I rewatched it again recently and was kind of struck by wanting to see Denzel on the screen a lot more than Kevin Kline. But it's really a story of Kevin Kline's journey. Or his character's journey. And you kind of can see how it's done through the white eyes of the scriptwriter and the director, which is also true of some of the films that we've got in 1989, but we're starting to see some changes. So I've given our class a few grades. I'll be curious to see if you agree. I've got two A plus students, sort of my star pupils. I've got two disappointments and two that I'm giving a grade of incomplete. They are also a disappointment in some sense or another. But should we go best to worst or save the best for last? How do you want to walk through these here?
Well, Vincent is the actual academic in the room because he is a professor at Drexel University. So I'll let Vincent say which way we should handle this.
We'll start with the students that need improvement. You know,
okay.
See me during my office hours. Those students.
Okay. Well, let's start with one I'm sort of thinking of as the class clown, which is Lean on Me.
Okay. Wow.
This movie... I don't know what you thought of it. I mean, I had not seen this movie before, and I was kind of surprised that I hadn't even heard of it. And, you know, when I was kind of looking into it, I thought, okay, this sounds interesting. It's a movie about reforming a high school in Paterson, New Jersey, and, starring Morgan Freeman. Wow, this sounds like my kind of movie. And then directed by the guy who directed Rocky and the Karate Kid. And I thought, uh-oh.
That's right.
And that was kind of how I felt, that it was just a bit of a mess. What was your impression?
You want to start, Lynn?
Well, I'm curious, were you even aware of the story of Joe Clark?
No. And, you know, I looked it up afterwards. And so this is the Morgan Freeman character, Joe Clark, who was he was on the cover of, I don't know, Time Magazine or Newsweek or something. And he had kind of, he's, I think Roger Ebert said he's the Dirty Harry of the educational system of Patterson, New Jersey. That it's
that is pretty much Joe Clark. That is
He went in and he said, "I'm going to use some unconventional methods. I'm going to expel a bunch of problem students. I'm going to take a tough line with the rest of them, and we are going to turn this school around." And the movie seems to have taken that concept and said, what if that were really the way to fix these schools? We could turn this into a real kind of feel-good story where everybody's excited about how tough he is and all of these unconventional methods. And of course, you can't really watch Morgan Freeman without rooting for him. So he's got that going for him. He's, you know, is just, you always kind of want to see Morgan Freeman do well. But the movie is so obviously just pressing these Hollywood buttons to have scene after scene of you know, this sort of rah-rah, like it feels like the Karate Kid. Like here's the scene where he's kicking the villain in the crotch, and here's the scene where he's, you know, that kind of thing. And you start to feel like it's really probably not the way to turn a school around. And in fact, when I read more about Joe Clark, I learned he didn't turn the school around the way that the film wants to make you think that he did. And it just seemed like it was, as much as I enjoyed Morgan Freeman, as I always do, I really started thinking that this was a movie that wasn't addressing anything worthwhile. And it kind of missed out on the chance to give us what might have been a really interesting character study of Joe Clark.
Absolutely. It's just a movie that, like you said, it's just trying to be Rocky in school, right? Yeah. And now the thing is that with Joe Clark, the actual Joe Clark, he was braggadocious. He was over the top. Hmm. So you can't say that Morgan Freeman took it to 10, because Joe Clark was already on 12, right?
Yeah.
So you can't say that. But the fact of the matter is that if he's going to be on 12, first of all, you can't have the school being on 12. The way that the school is depicted is so much what white America wanted us to believe that black schools were like they were just these wild, unhinged, unruly people just running north and south, and that the teachers just had no control whatsoever, and that you needed like this tough drill sergeant to get in there. Yeah, that's what these black kids need. They need somebody. Yep. That's what the story that movie is trying to purport. And unfortunately, Joe Clark, because of, you know, he was an older guy, and we've all got those people who, you know, like, get off my lawn, and like, oh, these damn kids. I mean, he was that type of guy who went in there with that type of rah-rah ethic. That was a story that you saw. He was on Time Magazine. He was on magazines and newspapers everywhere. The media was ready to lynch on and celebrate. I mean, it's only when you really dig into it, you realize that this actually is not working. The pushback that they tried to kind of touch on a little bit in the film was real, but only in the film they villainized it. And it was very interesting that they turned that villain to, wait for it, a black woman in that movie as well. So it really was a movie that just, I don't remember, it wasn't a huge hit, because as much as people thought that people, you know, like, oh yeah, they can't wait to see the Joe Clark movie, it really wasn't. People didn't rally to that, because Black America realized how much of a false narrative that was. And they could see, like, oh, this is not how we see it. This is how y'all see it. And we are not going to dig up and support this BS that you're trying to run on us. The shame of it is, like you said, they've got Morgan Freeman in this film. The beautiful thing is that Morgan Freeman in 1989 has three times at bat to really win our hearts.
That's right.
So, you know, he swung and missed with this one.
So are you saying that the black audience might have had a problem with how Morgan Freeman is portrayed at first, where he's teaching at the school, the students are all white, he's teaching them about civil rights, and then he leaves in a union dispute, he's been betrayed by some fellow teachers, and then we cut to the school 20 years later, where it's full of black students, and they're playing Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Jungle. As the
very subtle.
They play a montage. They play the entire song. It just kept going and going. I couldn't believe it. And
I know.
I'd like to think that somebody in Hollywood would point that out today. But to see that in 1989 as kind of, like you say, not too subtle. The other problem I had with it is it kind of glosses over the how to educate, and it, you know, in favor of these feel good moments, like in order to get the plot rolling, it sets up this thing where they need to take this standardized test and they need to all do better in order to rescue Morgan Freeman and save these methods, you know, and justify what he's been doing and all of that. And then they don't really show any instances other than they expel the problem students. They don't really show any changes in how to reach kids or how to educate kids other than, you know, at one point they've taken a practice test and a kid sort of starts to fall asleep and someone else nudges them with an elbow. And that's supposed to show that they're going to all pitch in together and work hard together and all of that. But it doesn't do any of the work of here's how the students are being treated by the teachers in the past, and here's what's going to change in order to actually help them improve.
Exactly. Well, the thing is that the idea they're trying to show is, okay, they do this big thing about, you know, getting all the bad kids up in the auditorium. They're up on stage. They're given their moment in the sun just to kick them out of the school because they have been what's been holding back the school. And this is what's been holding back you students from prospering, right? And they are what's been holding back the teachers from actually doing their jobs. Okay. So if you're going to make this big production of doing that, then you, like you said, you have to show the other side. You have to now show the teachers, okay, now they have the opportunity to focus in on the students. Now the students that want to listen, they do have the opportunity to, you know, actually pay attention and learn without distraction in the classroom. But the movie doesn't have any time for that. It doesn't really want to show the progressiveness of any education going on. They just want to go from Hollywood moment to Hollywood moment to Hollywood moment, set piece, set piece, set piece.
Yep.
And it's not really wanting to tell the full story. And that is a shame. Now, some people might say that is the nature of Hollywood at that time. You know, maybe the Joe Clark story would have been better served as a TV series or as opposed to a movie. It certainly is a story that if it was done now, it probably would be done with a lot more nuance. It would be some type of, like, you know, akin to the Wire on HBO or something like that. But at that time, they didn't have any time for that. And like you said, you've got the mastermind behind Rocky and the Karate Kid doing Lean on Me. Like, he came up with a fat track, you know, that got Big Daddy Kane and said, we're good to go.
Yeah. So I want to pivot to A Dry White Season next. But there's a line in A Dry White Season that stood out to me as kind of addressing Lean on Me and movies like that, where Marlon Brando is playing this civil rights lawyer and he says, in South Africa, and he says, every time I win a case, they change the laws. And that's a more interesting story. And it would be a story applicable to Paterson, New Jersey as well. What are the institutional pressures here? What are the, you know, why is the deck stacked against these students and these teachers? And Joe Clark really not only doesn't give an answer to that, it gives kind of a false answer, and it becomes right. sort of this Hollywood fantasy, and kind of a fantasy, like we were saying at the beginning, that, oh, if only there was more discipline, and if only someone would just get tough and crack down, we could solve all of these issues and everything. And it really doesn't address what Marlon Brando is suggesting, which is, well, even if you're able to change something here, chances are you'll lose the battle in the state house, or the legislature will change something, or the neighborhood will change something. And there's bigger societal problems that are going to stop you from fixing things with just a teacher who carries a gun and chains the doors closed.
Right.
And this one, A Dry White Season, I really wanted to thank you guys for bringing it to my attention. It was just a revelation for me, and it made me sort of miss the days when people would actually go to see movies and take more of a, they would become part of the cultural conversation a little bit more. It felt like this was a grown-up movie for grown-ups.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah. The director, it's just a wonderful style, and she's French, or has some kind of French background, and it reminded me of that sort of French New Wave films, that the camera was close and the way things were framed, and even the action scenes kind of feels like we're getting these moments in the real world that felt almost like a documentary style in a way that just felt very fresh and contained. But the ideas in this film were really impressive and something to see.
Yeah, you know, like you said, it's very mature filmmaking. It's almost a prestige level of filmmaking. And I'm fascinated by these South African films during mm-hmm. this moment, like just referenced Cry Freedom. And you have almost this sleight of hand that goes on during this moment. And again, 1989, you have these two films where you see two sides of it, where you're talking about Lean on Me, which doesn't address structural challenges at all.
Yeah.
But you have a film like this that really does, again, talk about the system of apartheid. And whether we're talking about this or Cry Freedom, or in a lot of ways, the other type of film like this, the film that focuses on segregation era America. And, you know, I'm thinking about something like The Ghost of Mississippi.
Mm.
In 1989, we really want to say it's almost a cult of personality, where the right person in the right place does this, and we can change things, because no one wants to go to the movies and deal with those complicated issues.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, Joe Clark was never a success at what he did, because you can't beat up institutional racism and structural inequity with a baseball bat.
Right.
But that doesn't make for a good film. And A Dry White Season has its issues. You know, obviously it centers whiteness in this film about black people. But as you said, it's a really grown up kind of sober, kind of very almost genteel mannered approach to filmmaking in this year, where when you look at the other examples we're talking about, it's, you can almost measure the appeal using popcorn.
Yeah. Well, it does center white people, but I felt like in a way I really appreciated that in a way that I didn't in a movie like Cry Freedom, because I couldn't believe how close this was in the rhetoric and the themes to mm-hmm. the discussions that we're having today on wokeness.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this could be a dry woke season. because what it's about, I'm guessing that a lot of listeners maybe haven't seen it yet. You know, Donald Sutherland plays this character who is in apartheid South Africa, and he is waking up to the idea that there are systemic injustices, that it's not just a few bad apples, but it's the institutions have prejudice embedded in them. And it seems like, you know, for a lot of Americans, it's probably going to be easier to watch this
taking place in apartheid South Africa and kind of subtract away all of the current political back and forth that we have, and everyone's positions are kind of rooted in, and you're watching something in apartheid South Africa. So you know that the injustice is there, but the same arguments that you hear are the arguments that he's expressing at first, and that he's kind of realizing no longer hold water, that he starts out just saying, you know, well, there's nothing to be done, or if the police did something wrong, then they'll be brought to justice. And it's what I liked about it in terms of centering the white experience is it seems like the filmmaker is saying white supremacy is a white person problem. And it's something that, you know, what the Donald Sutherland, what he's going to do is going to be essential to whether anything changes.
That is an interesting way of looking at it. And it also probably speaks to why this is a film that is missed by a lot of people. Because that is, first of all, it's not an easy film to watch. As you mentioned, the violence, which they have to show because this was just what was going on at the time, is very visceral. It is very upfront in your face. And Zane Palfrey, the director, has said she did that purposefully because she wanted to bring those images to the screen. She didn't want it to be sanitized in any way like they would do on news coverage. She wanted to be upfront and blunt about what was happening because this was violence that was being put upon these people, and not just the men and women. This was, in fact, affecting the children as well. And that is all up there on screen. And that is not an easy thing to take in at all. But the other hard pill, like you said, is the white supremacy being so systemic that it is the law there. And sitting in an American theater, remember 1989, you're only 20 years away from the outside of the 60s. So you have people that are sitting in the film that remember hoses being turned on them, that had family members that were lynched for no reason but the color of their skin, right? And you're asking people to sit in a movie theater side by side with people who have relatives and very recent ancestors who were the protagonists of such violence against our people. That is a hard, hard pill to swallow in such a visceral way on that screen, because say what you will about this being a film that to a degree had to be codified for the white lens, you do have Donald Sutherland and Marlon Brando up on that screen, two of our greatest actors ever, being very forthright in their portrayal of their characters. Like, the reason why I can't believe Donald Sutherland can't see what's happening right before his eyes is because I know Donald Sutherland is the smarter person than this. But that's Donald Sutherland. But that man that he's portraying on there, I get it. That's just the blind eye that a lot of white people had. It was the privilege of being able to have that blind eye and having it ripped open right there. It is a film that is worth revisiting, you're right, and being screened today. We should make that happen, Vince. Write that down.
Well, there's also, I mean, just the way that it's done, one of the things I started to pick up on is how, as he's going from place to place, trying to talk to the other white people and to kind of try to find out what happened to this gardener's son and get some justice or just get some answers, I noticed that the scenes kept beginning with laughter, where the white people were always laughing, they were having a good time. And then he would come in, this unwelcome interruption, where he's there to try to talk about something serious. And we saw the horrors that we're immersed in the tragedy, and we feel the frustration of him not getting
the answers, and we feel the frustration of, oh, these other guys just want this all to go away. They want to get back to their clubby world where they can pretend that nothing is happening. And it really sort of hit home in the sense of he's everything around him, all the people around him, his family members. It would just be easy if he would just stop trying to pursue the truth. And, you know, his daughter says something that rang true to me, too, is when she said, I just want things to be the way they were, mm-hmm. you know, and it's very similar to what you might hear today from people who are saying, you know, why do we have to do this? Why do we, you know, the sort of anti-woke voice of, weren't things fine before everyone started complaining about them?
Or said another way, make America great again.
Make America great again. Yeah. Again. As if it, you know, what era are we going back to? Like it.
Exactly.
But I really felt like, and I'm sort of, Brando too. He hadn't been in a movie for 9 years when he came out for mm-hmm. this one. And got such a thing, but I really appreciated they didn't make him the hero who was going to save the day and win the case. Yeah. He was a character who could use sarcasm and irony because they're the only weapons available to him, but he too is basically powerless, and he's stuck in this world. Susan Sarandon is in it as well. Her character didn't have as much to do, but I felt like, and maybe we can move to my other star pupil, Do the Right Thing, because I felt like I was getting two halves of a sentence with these two mm-hmm. movies. And the first half was, you know, white supremacy is a white person problem. And Do the Right Thing was saying, okay, so what does that mean for a black person who wants to exert some agency? So if this mm-hmm. is, if this is a white person problem, and we're in America today, not South Africa, but we have some of these problems too, then what do you expect a black person to do? What is the right thing to do? Is that kind of the starting point for Do the Right Thing?
Well, I think the brilliance of Do the Right Thing really does rest in the title. And yeah. Spike Lee has always articulated that that's where he kind of built up from, like, what is the right thing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the right thing? And the thing that I have always loved about Do the Right Thing is, depending on who you talk to, depending on when you talk to them, everyone has different answers. And in this year of films that, you know, you can bounce in between them, and, you know, whether these films are recreating the past, whether these films are addressing kind of structural issues or talking about how much individual action affects things. You have this wonderful balance of all of them in this film where, you know, in 1989, he's talking about regentrification. He's talking about, you know, what does it mean to own property? And but he's talking about economic empowerment and representation. And it's all kind of centered in these wonderful performances by everyone, whether we're talking about, you know, it's like a murderer's row.
I know. The cast is, yeah. I showed this to both of my kids when I felt they were old enough. And that is one of the pleasures, is to sort of say, hey, you recognize that? That's Gus Fring. And there's mm-hmm. Samuel L. Right, Jackson. Right. And you know, they knew Spike Lee from stuff. And there's just a... It is a wonderful cast. It's kind of a perfect movie in a way. It really has held up, and it just, every scene is exciting and visually appealing. And, you know, John Turturro's performance, Danny Aiello, they're really, it's kind of a magnetic movie. I felt like it was one, you know, often when I go back to the 80s and show my kids movies, I sort of have forgotten how slow certain parts are or how some of it is right. Special effects. We've kind of moved on and that kind of thing. But this is one I felt like it could have been, you know, could have come out last year.
Except for the Jordans, This yeah. is pretty much timeless. I mean, right. even that, though, even the Jordans, though, they've reissued those Jordans at least three times since this film came out. And, certainly you see kids wearing those Jordans. I was going to just say the timelessness of it. I think part of it is, of all of these films, in a lot of ways, this is the most sort of modern one, I guess, the one that looks like I think Do the Right Thing kind of integrated those fast cuts that you see post MTV. I think the dialogue is fast and snappy. So, you know, certainly on the hottest day of the year, it's a bright film. Mm-hmm. So just on that level, you know, I think you're right. This is a film that you can show to young people.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like you're taking them to school.
Right.
But I'm a huge, huge fan of Do the Right Thing. So regardless of what element you want to address, I agree with you about everything.
I was just going to say the other thing I would point out about it is that of all of these films, I think one of the reasons why it is still holds up is because it is such a beautiful looking movie. Mm-hmm. And that is because of the cinematography of Ernest Dickerson in this movie. This is, as he's done throughout his entire career, even after he moved on from working with Spike Lee, Ernest Dickerson is very aware of what the camera and lights and everything working together will do with the black skin. And he showcases our beauty and a diversity of tone so lovely in this movie, especially juxtaposed to Brooklyn at the time, which was undergoing its own evolution in 1989. It is just captivating and just beautiful. Every time I watch it, I spend some time just, I'll lose myself in just looking at the whole screen as opposed to the story and just taking everything in.
Yeah. Like those also, guys who are hot.
Mm-hmm.
And the colors on the wall behind them. And it just, it is such a visually sumptuous movie.
Well, it's also worth pointing out, as we're all in the middle of a renaissance of her career, this is also Ruth Carter costuming.
That's
like,
right.
You know, like Lynn mentioned the Jordans, but the reason you remember the Jordans is that there's such an intentional piece of costuming.
Yeah.
And if you look at the if you look at the clothing that everyone wears, whether it's his sister Jade or whether, you know, that wonderful Sal's Pizzeria shirt, the uniform, everything is so intentional. And so that you know, as Lynn said, Ernest Dickerson and his cinematography, part of the credit that I always give Spike Lee and some of the industry folks talk about this on the documentary is how he brought together this wonderful team of people.
Yeah.
That then go on to, you know, do all these other wonderful things, but you see it in Do the Right Thing.
Yeah. And Fight the Power is perfect.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Public Enemy. Enemy number one.
Yeah. That song, the way that it's used and just the intensity of it and when it gets turned up louder and louder.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is another front where the film is looking forward. I always think about this in comparison to something like Lean on Me, which we mentioned the black audience, but I do think there was a vein of the black audience, this sort of baby boomers moving into their 30s and 40s that liked this sentiment of you know, a black man coming in and putting down the, you know, laying down the law. I always call it pull up your pants. The movie.
Yep.
But Do the Right Thing is unapologetically
right.
a hip hop movie. Like this is, you know, whether we're talking about the Jordans, whether we're talking about Radio Raheem's boombox, whether we're talking about the Public Enemy, like Spike Lee is channeling that hip hop energy in 1989 in a way that most films hadn't caught on to yet.
Right. And it was, I mean, this is one of the themes of the movie too. And the sort of famous conversation in the pizzeria where they say, look at all of your heroes. You know, it's Michael Jackson, it's Prince, it's all of these black people, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson. And, you know, it kind of has that too, where the kids I knew who went to watch the movie, they wanted to talk like the characters. They wanted to talk like Mookie and the other characters. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do the things with their hands when they see each other. You know, instead of a handshake, they do a little,
you know,
they wanted to wear the clothes. They just wanted, it was so attractive and so, like you say, unapologetic for, and it just felt like not only that it felt real, but it felt like a notch above being real, that it was almost like this is what we should be aspiring to be, this kind of energy and this kind of camaraderie and this kind of community, you know, at least in the first like 2/3 of the movie. And then I also felt like, so for me, 1989 was the year I graduated from high school. And so I was literally the class of 1989. And was headed off to college. And that's where I started to realize movies were sort of taken seriously as films, and that there could be kind of an artistic movie, and started to watch some movies like Ingmar Bergman films and Kurosawa films. And I was waking up to all of this kind of Orson Welles and, you know, all of the sort of more sophisticated movies. And you get that there's Orson Welles and there's Hitchcock and there's Coppola and Scorsese. And then when we watched Do the Right Thing, it was like, we've got another one, Spike Lee. He's in that group, you know, and it was exciting to think that it was someone who was younger and American, and that it wasn't, you know, it was in English, and it was so smart. And so it was as entertaining as the Hollywood films, but it really avoided the Hollywood, you know, the unrealistic happy ending or the soft peddling of the harsher themes. It was so surprising that it was a movie that had an actual budget and looked like it belonged on the big screen, but it trusted the audience to come away with this greater understanding because the movie wasn't spelling out the answer for them.
Right. Well, that's the magic of somebody like Spike Lee, who is unapologetic about how he is going to wield his skills and hone his craft, in that he's not going to spoon feed you at all. He's just going to put it on there on the screen, and with the confidence that he's giving you enough to connect the dots, and then you and your experience, your thoughts, your ideals will then fill in the rest. And then hopefully you will walk away from the movie, pretty much any Spike Lee movie, talking about it, having questions, having conversations, because that's what the best movies do. They don't necessarily always tie up everything in a bow. There are some movies that are just cookie cutter and just there for entertainment. But then there are, like you said earlier, movies that are for adults, movies that live with you, that you think about, that you talk about. They begin conversations, they begin having an imprint on culture, and they move things. And that's what Do the Right Thing was doing.
Yeah.
And this is the moment, like this, you know, back to 1989 as the year, it's really the coming out party for so many of the players. Like, this is the moment where Spike Lee goes from indie darling to filmmaker. As you said, you have to take him seriously. This is the moment that, you know, we argue Denzel Washington becomes the icon with the one tear in glory. Yeah. This is the moment where Morgan Freeman, he
dominates the,
and he enters into his final transformation as this older, wiser character actor.
Mm-hmm.
And it all happens at this, you know, certainly Eddie Murphy is a star already, but Harlem Nights in a lot of ways is the vanity project of an icon.
Yeah.
Like only someone of my stature can do something like this. So it's a fascinating year.
Yeah. Well, we're starting to run out of time. So let's go to Driving Miss Daisy and make sure
we get there.
Because that one seems to just encapsulate everything we've been talking about when we sort of say, well, you know, Do the Right Thing is good because it's not doing the Hollywood thing. This is the movie that's doing the Hollywood thing. And as it does seem like almost one of those historical, you know, those great coincidences of history that it did come out in the same year. And it really exposes, well, this is the movie that Hollywood is not only thinks the audience is going to love, but it's going to give its prize to, versus the movie that is clearly the better movie and doesn't even get nominated. So what do you guys make of Driving Miss Daisy and how well that movie is held up and what we see in it when we look at it with our hindsight perspective?
We always like to point out that a lot of the Driving Miss Daisy criticism happened in real time as well. And even in the context of the Academy Awards, Driving Miss Daisy is one of a very small handful, like less than five films, of films that were nominated for Best Picture that the director wasn't nominated. So much so that you know, Billy Crystal had the infamous joke at the ceremony where he said Driving Miss Daisy, a film that apparently directed itself. And so I think, you know, I think Driving Miss Daisy has always had this foundation of being more of a political statement than a celebration of it as art. Like, again, 1989 is very volatile. We talk about Do the Right Thing and that powerful montage where in 1989, they're talking about all of the young black men that have been murdered by the police and had these encounters. And Driving Miss Daisy just is this kind of feel good throwback. And you know, throwback to a period that never actually existed, where, you know, you talk about this friendship between these two people. I've never been a fan of the film. I have to say that after doing the documentary, I've developed more complicated feelings about it, just as far as what it has brought to, you know, it's just, my dad loved this film. My dad, before he passed, was a huge fan of this film. And Lynn is a fan of the film, but, you know, I do think it's very saccharine. It's very, very much a snapshot of what you get at this moment. And frankly, whether we're talking about The Help or Green Book or a film that I'm sure will be out in the next 5 years, because Hollywood loves to go back to this well, it is an important film that represents a type of movie that Hollywood and to a certain extent America still enjoys.
It's sort of the equivalent of someone who is eager to address climate change and they change their light bulbs. And, you know, it feels like you might feel good about that you've done that, but you really have not taken on the difficult question of what's going to need to be done. And it really does not compare well with either Do the Right Thing or A Dry White Season in terms of that. It's sort of, you know, you get the sense that it's what Hollywood wants us to think, or maybe what we want to think, we Americans, that, you know, the problem is just if we could just learn to be a little bit nicer to each other, and right. And if, you know, if Daisy, like, she comes around eventually, she starts out thinking that Morgan Freeman is stealing from her and he's not, and eventually, you know, over several decades, she comes to really appreciate the friendship and his character. And Dan Aykroyd, that character is kind of set up like the hero throughout, that he's the guy who kind of gets it, that he gets Hoke and all of that. And then, you know, he's the one who basically at one point he's like, well, what do you mean go to a civil rights rally? The people I'm living around might not like that. And I've got a business to run. I could lose customers. And he's really not punished for that in any way. And you kind of get the feeling like the movie is sort of saying, you know, at the end, we can have friendship and loyalty and affection, and that's what counts. But it really doesn't, you know, it's really not going to count in the bigger scheme of things.
Of course, because we can have this friendship, we can have this relationship as long as it is on our terms, and we don't have to, you know, deal with any of the privileges that our skin affords us. Like you said, Miss Daisy, eventually, decades later, when she's dying, realizes that Hulk, you know, you might be the only person that can stand me. Really? I mean, maybe you didn't feel the famine.
Right. Right.
Exactly, and
it sends this message to the white audience. Well, all you need to do is don't accuse your black servants of stealing and you're good. You know, problem
you're
solved.
Right. You're good. Let them just sit in the kitchen, watch TV as long as until they drop dead at the sink like the maid. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
You'll be fine. That being said, I like the movie because... I like the movie because I appreciate the performance of Jessica Tandy in the role of Miss Daisy. I think she does a good job. I appreciate Morgan Freeman in this. I even appreciate the performance of Dan Aykroyd. Does the story hold up? No. Is it a great story? No. But I do get lost in a little bit of the silliness and sacredness of the story. I do. I understand. I don't knock anybody who hates this movie. I dig it. But I guess I'm Vincent's old dad. I find something that I can at least turn it on and I will sit there and watch it all the way to the end.
Right. Well, hey, I'm not going to criticize anybody who changes their light bulbs either. I mean, that's a good thing, right?
Right. You know, change your light bulb, man.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And it's, you know, Daisy does wind up in a better place than where she started.
Sure.
Okay, so my two incomplete were movies I got halfway with both of them, and then I started watching other things, and I meant to get back to them, and I ended up not finishing them. Glory, I had watched in the theater in 1989, and I remember Denzel and the tear. That's sort of the moment.
The movie has really been distilled down to just that moment over the years. Nobody remembers anything else but Denzel and the tear.
Yeah. And I felt like it wasn't a disaster like Lean on Me, but I also didn't think it was as interesting as Lean on Me, kind of for that reason, that it just felt like a little bit of a standard Hollywood fare other than some of the performances. And I did find myself wondering why it had to be told from Matthew Broderick's point of view. And then Harlem Nights, I was excited to watch it because I love Eddie Murphy, and the movie for me and Red Fox, I thought was really funny. Richard Pryor it's just such an uneven movie. And I've always found it hard not to blame it a little bit because I feel like, I don't know if this is actually true, but my impression is that it kind of broke Eddie Murphy a little bit, that I wish he'd been older when he made the movie he wanted to make, or, you know, it just seems like, it kind of didn't go well. It wasn't received well. And then I feel like we sort of lost Eddie Murphy for a while to kids' movies. And when you hear him now, and he's kind of come back to being the Eddie Murphy who is so grown and matured, I kind of wish we had him in his 30s and 40s making films and using some of his talents to kind of, you know, do some more interesting projects than the ones that he actually did.
Well, I think the problem with Harlem Nights is, you're right, it is Eddie Murphy. This is his vanity project. This is his opportunity to work with Red Fox and Richard Pryor, his idols in comedy. But Eddie is also at a moment where he is definitely feeling himself. And I think he's learning to be generous on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he 100% cements it in this movie. Plus, you also got to recognize it's not only this is a vanity project, he directs it and he writes it as well. So
right.
Eddie, as a writer, is always going to be able to write in his own voice, but he's maybe not as nuanced, not as skilled in writing a full story that is filled with fully fleshed out characters. And the proof is up there on the screen, and never mind him being a director and, you know, maybe not having the visual flair there. But the other thing that does hurt the film, you know, with all that aside, is that he gets his idol, which is Richard Pryor, but this is a greatly diminished Richard Pryor. This is not the Richard Pryor he grew up with. And that is right there on the screen. He's relatively healthy. You know, he's not leaning on a set or anything, but he's not the Richard Pryor that we know. He's not the Richard Pryor that Eddie, I think, really wants up on that screen that could maybe go toe to toe with him. And then you've got Red Fox, who's older than both of them. So while he's giving it his all, he's not in the, you know, prime condition himself. So now Eddie is left to really be the drive of that film. And that, you know, just kind of like stacks the deck against it being the success that it really should have been.
Yeah.
It's certainly this moment where Eddie Murphy is flying too close to the sun. like he really is. Like he tries to do everything. He's gathered these folks that, you know, again, I think he has attained this level of celebrity where no one is telling him no.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are no no's in his life. And this is the film you could tell he's wanted to make pretty much since he was a kid, whether we're talking about him dressing up like a gangster and he wears white to stand out from the other gangsters. You know, as we've mentioned, he has his idols involved, both his uncle and his brother, who we now know Charlie Murphy, are involved. There are all these comedians, and there just isn't a real driving force to bring it all together. And I thought that's interesting when you say it kind of breaks him because, you know, certainly while Coming to America comes out after this, which I would argue is like the ultimate Eddie Murphy film, that Eddie Murphy rock star energy, you certainly don't see anymore after Harlem Night, where again, I'm not a comedian, I'm a rock star,
right,
which is what he had been. And it does. I think it's a film that does not age that well. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of that does have to do with the roles or lack thereof of the women in the film. But, I can see. And as far as Glory, you know, Glory, I think Glory was very much a film of that moment. I will have to say the one bit of defense that I always give Glory, centering the Matthew Broderick character, is that, you know, the film is based on the journals of that character. You know, you can make the argument, well, of course he would be the center of it because it's based on his writings, but it certainly is not a film that I think could be made today without a great deal of pushback.
Mm-hmm.
And as Lynn said, I really do think when people think of Glory, they just think of that scene of Denzel Washington with that one tear, which says a lot about the film itself, that's all you remember.
I wonder how much of that is our greater cultural awareness and the work that's been done in academia and elsewhere to point out that these movies that were seen from the white perspective were missing out on the narratives or not telling the full story, and how much of it was due to these actors. Because when you watch Morgan Freeman in any of these movies, or when you watch Denzel,
and you're so drawn to them, and you end up thinking, well, that would have been a more interesting person to watch
right.
for the 2 hours that I just spent. And why didn't I watch that person for those 2 hours? Why was I stuck watching Kevin Klein and his family when I could have been watching what was going on with Stephen Biko for the rest of the time that I was sitting there? And because they're so magnetic and so charismatic, I wonder how much we can attribute to just those individual stars and the acting performances they were turning in to kind of help people change their approach to making films like this.
I think you can look at it that way. And certainly when you look at their careers, speaking specifically of Morgan Freeman and Denzel Washington, you can see how they've carved out careers and filmographies that they are the center characters in films that, in a lot of ways on paper, the characters could be played by white actors. But I do think, again, going back to Do the Right Thing, I think that you have this moment with Spike Lee and Usain Palsy, as was pointed out to Lynn and me, where you start to have black people telling the stories.
Right. That's what changes it.
And, you know, I think one of the wonderful things about the legacy of Spike Lee is you hear so many directors of color since then say, I saw Spike Lee do it, and that made me think that I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think also that just speaking to the industry and just certainly America at large at the time, the default point of view was the white point of view. The default point of view in everything is the white perspective. You know, that's the privilege under which America has operated since its beginning. And it's despite small pockets of upheaval, that has pretty much been SOP since, you know, America was found. And it's only in the 80s, really, when that black perspective is starting to take hold. Because as much as people, when they think about blacks in films, people automatically go to the blaxploitation film era, the 70s. And they're quick to just big up all the, you know, the black action, gangster movies, you know, Black Against the Man and everything like that. And so that they could easily just put that in the drawers, like, oh yeah, that's that little thing that they did here. You know, they made them feel good. Right. That's why even Hollywood started making some of those movies as well. You know, they saw they hit. It was like, oh, sure. We'll make our versions of their films, always, you know, jumping on the trend like they do. But it's only really that autonomy and seeing how that hit that starts to slowly build from the early to mid 70s into the early 80s. And now we're in the late 80s. Spike is hit. Eddie, like Vincent said, is a certified rock star. Now we have a little bit of agency in Hollywood, and more, and it just continues on to today, we are taking hold of our narrative, because that is the first step in being 100% free, totally self-actualization of black people. It's just owning your narrative and changing the default. And now, like Vincent said, people say, I saw Spike do it, I can do it. And now you see Latinos saying, I saw Spike do it, I saw the black people do it, I can do it. You see it everywhere. And that is why you have such this pushback against wokeness. It ain't wokeness. It's been happening all along. But because the default has been white for so long, they just didn't want to admit it. They didn't want to see it. Now they are forced to see it, and they don't know what to do about it because they don't have the weapons to fight against that. We have been building these weapons all along. We have been forged in iron and fire since the beginning of this country. We know how to deal with this shit. Excuse me. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to be able to top that. The podcasts are called The Michaud Mission and The Class of 1989.
And I'm going to throw in a plug for A Dry White Season, which I think people is, it's pretty easy to see, actually, if people have, I think it's on Amazon Prime. There's also a documentary called Oscar Mischa, The Superhero of Black Filmmaking, which I want to check out. I think that's on HBO Max.
Yes, it is.
Len Webb and Vincent Williams, thank you so much for joining me on The History of Literature.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Okay, that's going to do it for The History of Literature for today. My thanks to Len and Vincent for joining me. You can find their podcasts, The Class of 1989 and The Mischa Mission, wherever you found this podcast. And my thanks to Judy Bloom for fighting the good fight, being like a second mom to me and all those other kids trying to make our way through the world in the 1970s and 1980s and other decades too. Next up will be Lord Byron. We'll be talking to his biographer with a special focus on Byron's humor. He wasn't just a poet devoted to revolution and brooding romanticism. He was also very funny. We'll hear that story next time on Thursday. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.